Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO Portland, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour, views, reviews, and interviews from the ground up. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I'll be your host for the next hour. The music you are listening to is called Palestine Will Never Die by Low Key and featuring My Khalil. We are now in our final week of our fall funding drive. If you haven't yet and you are able, please help us to reach our $30,000 goal and keep volunteer-powered radio alive in Portland. Every dollar you give this week will be matched up to $11,000 thanks to generous donors like you. You can donate by going to kboo.fm/give, by texting KBOO to 44321, or by sending a check to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. KBOO thanks you. Today's Mole focuses a lot on history, how what happened in the past lives on within us, and how much we can learn from history in order to make this a better world. We've all been told how important it is to avoid the mistakes of the past, but sometimes it's even more crucial to recapture the best of what happened in the past and make it live again. This morning, I'll be reading a review by book mole Larry Bolden of a debut novel about five generations of a Chicano family in Denver who cannot escape the racist and colonial past of their homelands. The novel is called Woman of Light by Kali Fajardo-Anstein. Desiree Helligers will speak with radical queer white elder activist Kendall, known as Portland's People's Photographer, about their early life suspended between black and white communities and how that early experience of a kind of American apartheid shaped their later work and activism. We'll close our show with excerpts from an article that traces the contentious history of the concept of genocide by scholar Linda Kinstler, who emphasizes activist efforts to reclaim earlier and broader understandings of the practice of genocide. To begin our show, Joe Clement looks at libraries as remnants of the much more robust commons that used to characterize our communities. Joe draws on his own experiences as a library worker to argue that current attacks on books and libraries are part of a larger and deeper right-wing project to destroy the commons, in which the practice of sharing resources binds us together in community. In his commentary, Joe draws on a couple of podcasts. Maryam Kaba, on her podcast, Death Panel, speaks to how libraries can help us rediscover a historical grammar of commoning. Sean Valle of the Seriously Wrong podcast speaks as a guest on the Library Punk podcast about how the free use of abundantly circulating public goods can underpin solutions to contemporary ecological and social crises. This segment originally aired on April 8th of this year. Here's Joe.
Good morning. I'm Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Libraries in their diverse species are under attack. Book challenges have risen in the last several years and by over 90% in 2023 alone. What's more is they are increasingly coming from organized groups like Moms for Liberty. Book bans have been enacted by states, cities, and schools, while some libraries are being defunded and disbanded. In 2022, the city manager of Huntsville, Texas, closed the city library to remove books and dismantle the LGBTQ display. And then last year, the city council voted to privatize management through library systems and services. You might remember them because I reported on them a couple weeks ago as the former employer of the new director of Fort Vancouver Regional Libraries. Also locally, Portland Public Schools is cutting dozens of library staff and open hours. In the media, though, these attacks tend to be framed as a sensational culture war, but below the surface, the mole roots at the class war. Writing for Truthout about how attacks on libraries are attacks on labor, Jamie Taylor argues for a more worker-centric understanding of the situation. Quote, "What we see now are concerted attacks not just on books and authors, but on the expertise of library workers. Nobody knows this better than rank-and-file library workers. If libraries are the terrain of struggle, we are the people most directly involved in the fight. Our efforts are made all the more difficult when our institutions actively work against us. Alongside the very public efforts to ban books from library shelves, library workers face a host of other challenges that directly impact our capacity to do the work necessary to preserve these institutions." End quote. Jamie then describes library management busting the, spoiler alert, ultimately successful union drive in Baltimore County libraries and attacks like what I described already, but then goes on to include, quote, "Core library functions, including collection development and resource description, are contracted out to for-profit private companies that lock us into expensive systems we don't control. These issues may not be as well discussed as Breitbart calling us all groomers, but they are every bit as insidious, stripping our institutions of the very people best positioned to save them. Libraries are crucial social infrastructure. Like the post office, they're a site for the circulation of public goods, such as books and films, but also tax forms, overdose prevention medications, such as Narcan, and COVID tests. Like parks, library buildings produce space for the public where anyone can use the bathroom, grab some computer time, sit down, stay warm in the cold, and cool in the heat. And like all social infrastructure, libraries are under attack from an organized right that knows well that the best way to crater public institutions is to relentlessly attack them until they become unusable, leading to their abandonment by everybody except those who have no other choice. We need a strong library workforce equipped to resist the dismantling of our public institutions." End quote. Libraries are attacked by reactionary right-wing forces from without, but also from within, by managers and public officials who use technology to cut costs by squeezing labor, devaluing collections, re-enclosing library commons through corporate outsourcing. Mariam Kaba is the author of the book Let This Radicalize You and co-founder of For the People, the Leftist Library Project, which aims to systematically research, document, and guide people to access mechanisms of democratic library governance through library boards and different levels of government to push a pro-people, pro-library agenda. She riffs on this theme of libraries under attack with the authors of the book Health Communism on their podcast Death Panel and starts cooking on commenting.
I've been arguing that the public library is probably the last U.S. institution where the word commoning makes any sense at all. And it's for that reason for me that public libraries are important sites of struggle for leftists, and that because public libraries are communal goods, that under capitalism, these goods are always at risk of being privatized or plundered or extracted. And this is precisely why they are under attack by the reactionary right wing. I feel like without that being the center, the free speech stuff is just not it. That's not why they are the center fight for the right. The right has a larger project, y'all, that has been a long-term investment. And we aren't in the same way so explicitly clear about that. You know, we on the left, at least I thought, that our goal in part was to refuse the forced conversion of life forms into market relations, that was a central value, that we do not want a commodified public library, right? And more importantly, that our goal should be to encourage and expand democratic public control over all our institutions. Like, these are things that I think we somehow, if you talk to people on the left, like, people agree with, but we aren't making it central to our fight and constantly talking about it in the same way that the right is committed to having an ideological and material struggle against these institutions. And for me, I've been thinking a lot. Brett Story, who I really appreciate a lot, who's an abolitionist thinker and filmmaker, did 12 Landscapes in Prison Land. I think it's the name of the film. I have to find the exact thing. I'm sure we can find it and put a link for people. I heard her giving a talk a few years ago, and she mentioned this thing that has stuck with me all the way since. She said that a lot of us in this current moment, like, we don't have a vocabulary or a grammar for the commons anymore. Mm-hmm. So that means that what's been lost to us is the commons as a way of thinking about, she said, how we belong to each other. And that to me was like, yes. Because for me, interdependence, belonging to each other, all those things are such important, crucial planks in the left political project. And we don't know how to have that conversation in public anymore. We don't have that conversation in explicit terms in common anymore. And libraries, to me, can actually help us to rediscover a grammar for the commons. And that's something we desperately need as we build towards, for me, an abolitionist horizon. So I feel very strongly that the institution of the public library, therefore, is just incredibly important to the broader, larger project on the left in this moment and moving forward. And that's in part why it's so essential for me, especially for young folks who did not grow up steeped in the ideas of commoning or in the ideas of a grammar and a vocabulary for the commons, and aren't steeped in and haven't grown up in a society where our interest is in pushing for an understanding of how we belong to each other. That claiming that space back for this is going to help develop the muscles we need for demands for more public institutions, more public goods. It gives us the grammar for understanding Medicare for all. It gives us the vocabulary for making demands that are beyond individualistic ones and that tell us that we deserve to have public goods that are shared in common for everybody.
This is Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. We were just listening to Mariam Kaba, abolitionist, library activist, community organizer, and author, talking about the grammar of commons and the social political significance of libraries for the left today and beyond. This connection between libraries and commoning is exactly what the Wrong Boys of the utopian sketch comedy podcast Seriously Wrong have spun into a comprehensive and fun political ideology they call library socialism. Taking the lending library as an intuition pump for socialist economic relations, they develop a set of strategic concepts from dissident Marxist Murray Bookchin's 1982 book, The Ecology of Freedom. Here's a clip of Seriously Wrong host Sean Voyer summarizing it on the leftist library worker podcast, Library Punk. Co-host Justin sets him up.
So did you want to do an introduction to library socialism at the base level and sort of introduce the groundwork concepts? Because I imagine we have one or two listeners who are probably screaming at their phones right now just at the idea of library socialism.
Hi, Steve.
Like, if you work in libraries, and we've talked a lot about like liberal ideology in libraries and democratic discourse in libraries. And so we're always very critical of romanticizing the idea of libraries. It's kind of one of our major things is trying to undermine most of the liberal ideology in the field. And I think that also has made us a little jaded to any kind of utopian thinking about libraries. But it's actually important to do. We used to have the fully automated luxury gay space communism. Yeah. And then Grimes
ruined
it.
Which we now just turned into our action oriented question. It's all boring now.
Yeah. Well, Grimes ruined the joke.
She did. Elon Musk. I swear to God.
Yeah. So library socialism, it's something we first started sort of describing in 2018 or 2019. And basically what we're attempting to do with it is describe a counter-hegemony, a utopian set of ideas that can be used to challenge neoliberalism, capitalist realism, and so on, to help people imagine a society that is radically different than our own, a society that people would actually want to live in. And we think that's an important thing to imagine the future that you want to be a part of as part of the process of creating it. And where it came from was, I was thinking about social ecologist Murray Bookchin talks about how the ecological crisis is a social crisis, that the ecological crisis that we face is a result of social relations. It's the brutal hierarchy of society that creates a situation where a small amount of people are making decisions that affect the entire biosphere and so on. So I was sort of thinking about that. And so we have these like two big crises, both caused by that sort of you know, neoliberal ideology, this everything must be markets, private property is natural, and so on. And it really clicked that the principle of usufruct, so a property relationship where you can use things and you can benefit from them, but you're not allowed to destroy it. It's not private property. It's a sort of commons property. It's something that can address both of those issues at once, because under the current system, we have too many resource throughputs causing an ecological crisis, and people don't get what they need at the same time. So we're overproducing and under-delivering under the current system. So we were sort of thinking about post-scarcity and what it would mean to have a society where everyone was able to get what they need. And that circulating property of usufructian property relations really resonated with us. And the natural metaphor that we leaned into on that was libraries, because libraries already exist and they function on this same logic that we share books. Everyone gets a chance to read the book. No one's allowed to destroy the book. And we don't hoard books. We share them, and so on. So that's the basic idea of library socialism, is that we can address the ecological crisis and the social crisis through changing property relations to a usufructian one along the lines of the public library. And in practice, public libraries are very complex. They exist in the real world. They're not a perfectly democratic utopian thing in every instance. Totally want to acknowledge that. But it is a good intuition pump, I think, for the majority of people. Libraries are a very popular institution when you compare them to other institutions. In society, there's a lot of institutional distrust, but libraries people still like. So without abridging our critique of libraries as they actually exist, I think they can be a useful intuition pump for creating that counter-hegemonic narrative for what are we actually searching for when we want to radically recreate society.
That was Sean Voyer talking about library socialism on the leftist library worker podcast, Library Punk. There are hundreds of community tool libraries around the country, more than a few in Portland, as well as more non-traditional collections being offered by public libraries, including the Letting Library of Milwaukee, Beaverton City Library, Hillsborough Public Library, Tigard Public Library, Cedar Mill and Bethany Community Library, Lake Oswego Public Library, Oregon City Public Library, all of which can be used interchangeably by patrons of any of these library systems, as well as Multnomah County, which is good because Multnomah County Library doesn't yet have a library of things. Berkeley Public Library, though, operates the largest public tool library in the country. They have tens of thousands of items. A few weeks ago, Berkeley City Council voted to expand its tool library and develop a share hub. Summer Choi of the Daily Californian reports, quote, "The recommendation to develop Berkeley Public Library's first share hub was approved at Tuesday's council meeting to expand the lending library into a center for community members to access services and supplies. The recommendation was drafted by council member Sophie Hahn, who initiated the idea and worked with the heads of Berkeley libraries. After years of working with Berkeley libraries and authoring the city's plastics ordinance, she noted, the recommendation is a clear way for Berkeley residents to reduce their waste. Hahn said, "I want to create a public system for vastly increasing our ability as Berkeley residents to share and reuse a wide variety of items and thereby support our zero waste goals. But I also want to help the library build on its existing tool lending program and make that collection even more relevant and expansive." End quote. This move finally takes seriously the bold mandate of the American Library Association's Statement on Sustainability from 2019, which includes, "In adopting sustainability as a core value of librarianship, ALA recognizes the findings in the latest report of the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. The report, written and edited by 91 scientists from 40 countries who analyzed more than 6,000 scientific studies in October 2018, found that the immediate consequences of climate change are far more dire than originally predicted, calling for a transformation of the world economy at a speed and scale that has no documented historic precedent." End quote. That brings us back to this year's National Library Week theme, Ready, Set, Library, and the question it poses to us, how do you library? For the Old Mole Variety Hour, I'm Joe Clement. Please check out the excellent podcasts Seriously Wrong, Library Punk, and Death Panel.
That was Joe Clement speaking about libraries as grammar schools for the commons. You can find links to the podcasts that were featured on the webpage for this show at kboo.fm. You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, and I'm your host, Patricia Kohlberg. KBOO is not your ordinary radio station. It's do-it-yourself radio, Dozens and dozens of volunteers bringing you news and music and commentary from every corner of our community. And it's listeners like you that make it possible. We're in our final week of our fall pledge drive, and every dollar donated this week will be matched up to $11,000. Please help us reach our $30,000 goal. You can donate by going to kboo.fm/give, by texting KBOO to 44321, or by sending a check to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. KBOO thanks you. The 2024 novel titled Woman of Light by Collie Fajardo-Anstein tells the story of Luz Lopez and five generations of her Chicano family. The story, set in Denver in the 1930s, explores how the racism and colonialism of the past haunts the present and shapes the future. I'm going to read a review of the novel by Bookmole Larry Bolden. Here is what Larry writes. I'm assuming that all obsessive readers go through some flat periods, fearing that they have run out of really good books or have simply lost the burning desire to read. I recently went through such a period, starting four or five different books and then putting them aside after 100 pages or so, until I ran into Collie Fajardo-Anstein and her superb 2024 novel, Woman of Light. This novel, like so many modern novels, jumps between narrators, locations, and even centuries. It begins in the Lost Territory in 1868, where the main character Luz, Little Light Lopez, is introduced, and then jumps to 1933 Denver, where most of the story takes place. Little Luz is a tea leaf reader and laundress. She lives with her aunt Maria Jose, who tells her, "You cannot trust a man. Nearly all of them have some kind of deficiency, some malformation. They've been hurt a lot, menfolk, but they do most of the hurting, too." End quote. Diego, Luz's older brother, is a snake charmer and factory worker who supports her and her aunt until he is run out of town by an angry white mob and fears to return. It is in Denver that Luz begins to have visions that take her back to her indigenous homeland in the Lost Territories. Maria Jose sells the possessions Diego has left behind because she and Luz desperately need the money. Quote, "In some ways, Luz was glad Diego's things were gone. His objects felt charged with a piece of him. Their mother used to say that was part of Luz's sight, her ability to sense a person through their possession. Luz could feel Diego on anything her brother had touched, even the letters he sent." End quote. Besides a strong stream of feminism that flows through this story, Fajardo-Anstein also explores the intense racism of Denver in the 30s against blacks, Indians, Catholics, and communists. Quote, "There were many places she had been told she wasn't allowed. Denver Dry Goods, Elitch Gardens, Over the Dead in Cheeseman Park, and now, here, some rich neighborhood's library. I just need to look for jobs," she said. "We have our own people who need jobs. I suggest you try your own neighborhood." "But my neighborhood doesn't have a library." Luz thought this, but didn't say it, not wanting to give the satisfaction of knowing they had more than she did. End quote. Luz finds work in a law office and there begins to discover the systemic racism directed against pretty much all minority workers. David, the lawyer she works for, has little Spanish, and so he begins to have Luz translate his briefs from English to Spanish. Trying to find a lavatory in a fancy restaurant David has taken her to, quote, "Wherever Luz walked, she caught the eyes of men, menacing like owls in three-piece suits and gold pocket watches." "Are you his latest?" said the waitress from earlier. She had stopped Luz as she exited the dining hall. I don't know what you mean, Luce said. His latest girl? She was carrying a tray of pink glasses. Do yourself a favor, honey, and don't get your hopes up. The waitress moved her eyes towards David, who was laughing with Steelman at the table. A good Greek boy like that? He wants in, and girls like you aren't allowed in, ever. In where? Said Luce. The waitress rolled her eyes. Look around you, she said. The entire room, it seemed, laughed as one, their mouths open like dark pits. White women only. End quote. I don't want to give away too much of the story, but I want to mention Fajardo Anstein's only other published book, a collection of short stories entitled Sabrina and Corina. As soon as I finished the 2024 novel, I decided I would read any and all she had written. One chapter in the novel is entitled Three Sisters, and like that chapter, almost all the short stories have sisters or cousins as narrators. The stories, like the novel, are all set in Denver, and as a commentator says on the jacket cover, quote, Sabrina and Corina is a moving narrative of unrelenting feminine power and an exploration of the universal experiences of abandonment, heritage, and an eternal sense of home. End quote. I hope Collie Fajardo Anstein continues to write stories of her heritage. She is a powerful voice for good. I have been talking about the two books of Collie Fajardo Anstein. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and I'm Patricia Kohlberg, reading today for Larry.
Mirado entre las flores, brindándome tú de ellas, tu corona y sus olores.
The music you just heard was La Parranda by Los Madrugadores, who were a very popular Mexican-American band playing during the Great Depression. Before that, Bookmole Larry Bolden reviewed the novel Woman of Light by Collie Fajardo Anstein. Is KBOO part of your life? Do you regularly tune in to 90.7 for music, news, local happenings, or perspectives you won't hear on commercial radio? Then please help keep your local non-commercial radio station on the air by contributing to our fall fund drive. Every dollar donated this last week of our drive will be matched up to $11,000, so it's a great time to give. You can donate by going to kboo.fm/give, by texting KBOO to 44321, or by sending a check to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Thank you for your support. From a childhood of poverty and abuse in Appalachia, Kendall, also known as Portland's People's Photographer, would go on to do oral history in Louisiana's Cancer Alley, teaching theater at Smith College and in universities in Lesotho and South Africa, and more than 30 years of teaching creative writing and theater of the oppressed in Louisiana, Texas, and South Africa. Desiree Helliger speaks with Kendall about their lifelong love of photography and their work documenting Portland social movements.
I'm speaking today with the much-loved radical queer white activist, organizer, elder, who goes by the single name Kendall. So you've had an absolutely sprawling life as an organizer, as an artist, as a writer, and threaded throughout all of that has been your work as a photographer. And I know that you have kind of earned the moniker awarded by Alyssa Pagan or Alyssa Pariah of being the People's Photographer of Portland or Portland's People's Photographer. Can you talk a little bit about how you arrived at this place?
Oh, I would love to talk about that. I first really discovered photography when I was 10 years old. I was living in New York, in Queens, And the exhibit of the Family of Man was mounted at the Metropolitan. And I could not go because I was a kid and my parents weren't interested. But someone on my block went and brought home a program. And in those days, a program was all photographs of everything that was in the exhibit. So it was photographs of the photographs in the exhibit called The Family of Man. And I loved that booklet. I read it over and over. I studied every picture. I saw the intimacy of the photographs. I think my favorite one in the whole book is of a woman lying across her bed, cleaning her fingernails. And I thought someone had to be in the room with the camera, and she was so relaxed and she trusted them so much that they could make that photograph. It was absolute a moment of recognition for me as a child and as an artist. And that from that moment on, I nagged my parents about how desperately I needed a camera. And they finally gave me one for Christmas the year I was 10. It was a little brownie camera with a flash attachment. And I still remember with excitement the smell of those blue bulbs exploding when you pressed the shutter button. I was suddenly a photojournalist.
Can we talk a little bit about your background coming into that moment, right? Because you grew up extremely poor in Appalachia, you know, marginalized for a variety of reasons. So to have arrived at that moment of identification, can you talk a little bit more about that background?
Oh, absolutely. I was born in 1945 in the tiny town of Hendersonville, North Carolina, in the Appalachian Mountains. My mother was the first person in the family to get education beyond high school. And she was expelled from university for becoming pregnant with me. So it brought great shame on the family. And the family was pretty hard scrabble and had hoped to sort of lift themselves up into the middle class. And the view that they held was that my mother, by doing this horrible thing and producing this illegitimate child, had wrecked the family's opportunities. And so I was born wrong. I knew that something was wrong. I wondered if I smelled funny. People in my white Sunday school class were not allowed to sit next to me. My mother gave me to my grandparents to raise because she was 21 and had to figure out how to make a living since she'd been kicked out of school for being pregnant. My grandfather worked in a hardware store in the black side of town. My grandmother worked as a lunchroom lady in the white side of town. And they made an arrangement that he would take me to work with him in the morning. And at lunchtime, when my grandmother finished her work and came home, he would take me to her on the white side of town. My first thing that I experienced was this apartheid, that there was one world on the one side of the tracks where it was all black people except for me and my grandfather, and another world on the other side of the tracks where it was all white people. And I was shunned by the white people and accepted by the black people. And so I loved that black community, and I dreaded having to go with my grandmother to the white side of town. And that was just my introduction to life in the universe. When I was 5 years old, my mother married a guy in the Air Force, and that's how I ended up being in New York City in 1956 for my 10th birthday, 55, sorry. From that early time, I had many questions, and I could not understand how the world worked and why it worked the way it did. And I hoped that I could stay in the black community, and I couldn't understand why I could not, or why I had to go over where I was being shunned and where it seemed very cold and unfriendly. And I think that that yearning for black community underlies much of my photography. And to skip way, way ahead, to occupy Portland, that is when I began to be active in Portland community as a photographer. And Soon after that, in 2015, I met Teresa Rayford and I began documenting the work of Don't Shoot Portland. And in the meantime, I was on the media committee in 2011 for Occupy Portland. And so I began establishing community in Portland, and I began the dream of my life, which was to be a photojournalist and to document what people do, particularly what people do for justice and what people do to bring communities together to work in solidarity with each other. I had had experiences of that in community organizing in the 60s and 70s, and later through my own work with people in prison and through my own work as a theater professor. I ended up working for 6 years in Africa, helping people put together theater as a way to solve problems using the idea of Theater of the Oppressed by Augusto Mowal, and teaching students in Africa how to do that kind of theater with their communities. So community has always been absolutely crucial to me. And I came to Portland in 2008, not knowing a soul. I retired and I moved here. And I chose this city because I could get subsidized housing here. And I, for many reasons, had no money and have always given away money if I did have the money. And so I needed subsidized housing because I had no further income except Social Security and I had no savings. So here I landed, not knowing a soul, not sure how to build community because I had no job, I had no family, I had no connection. And I floundered 2008, 9, 10, and boom, in 2011, Occupy Portland gave me a nexus on which I could build connection and community. And that set me on fire. I was at that time 66 years old, which was a kind of prime of life for me. I still had energy. I could still squat down on the ground without having to push myself back up. I had dreams and hopes and a drive to be in community, to meet people, to talk to. I should add that I'm a deeply introverted person, but with a camera, I can establish connection with people without having to talk very much. My worst nightmare is a kind of cocktail party where I have to make chit-chat conversation. I suck at that, but I can hold a camera, look someone in the eye, ask with my face, is it okay if I make a photograph? And they can say yes or no, and I will make one or not make one according to what they want. Also, after that initial community building time with Occupy Portland, I became active with Sisters of the Road, and I became a photographer for people who were houseless, because most people who were houseless had phones and could keep photographs in them, but the phones at that time did not have very good cameras in them. Now they're much better, but in 2011, most people had flip phones. And they could store photographs, but they really couldn't make photographs. So I recorded people's babies being born and people's marriages happening who were living in the street. I also very sadly and respectfully recorded memorials, because those happen more often than weddings and babies, with people living in the street. And I began to have community with the people who gathered at Sisters of the Road at that time. And then in 2015, when I met Teresa Rayford, I began documenting the work of Occupy Portland for three reasons. Number one, I wanted a photo record of the work that they were doing. Number two, I wanted people who were part of that work to know they were seen, loved, appreciated, and remembered by photographs. And number three, I wanted people who weren't yet involved to see what they were missing and to be drawn by the photographs into working with Don't Shoot Portland. And at the moment, the Black Gallery has an archival display that includes a great many of those early photographs. I photographed them from 2015 until 2020. And when the George Floyd protests happened during the COVID lockdown, I was not able to continue photographing them because I am old and I have asthma and I could not afford to either get COVID or tear gas. I didn't think I would live through either one of those. So I handed over at that point to some younger photographers who are still doing that work. I'd like to say also something about 2020 and what that did, because COVID separated us from our communities starting. And then Ted Wheeler's decision to use tear gas on protesters for 134 days was devastating. I know young women activists who still do not have regular menstrual periods because they had so much tear gas during that time. I know a woman who lost a baby, who was pregnant and lost a child because that tear gas was abortifacient. I know people who just have been horribly changed by the violence of the response by the city of Portland to these demonstrations of love and justice and desire for justice. And that ended a great period of community work for justice. It made surveillance such a frightening thing that people no longer liked being photographed. Being photographed meant that you could be identified by the police, identified by the FBI, identified by the Trump people. There was a zine passed around an anarchist circle called Smash That Camera, meaning that whoever came to the protest with the camera, you should destroy their camera because that was how the people in charge were going to arrest you and prosecute you and perhaps kill you. As I'm sure you know, that people were injured, terribly injured, supposedly by non-lethal means during those protests.
We had the American Death Squad killing of Reinhold, was it?
Yes, yes, who I had photographed. I knew Michael Reinhold, and he was executed. He was a victim of an extrajudicial killing. I would say that his entire body was skeletonized by the horrible, horrible response led by Donald Trump, because he was in charge of the FBI and the Secret Service at that time. So that kind of response shut down a great many community photographers, including me. And since then, I have been very, very careful when I do document protests, always to ask permission. And most of my photographs since then, I take from the back of people, just in case at some future point, photographs could be used for surveillance and for attack. So that's the change that I saw happen during the George Floyd protests. Our community has been wonderful about fighting back. Our community has been brave and courageous, and there were a great many people out for every single one of those 134 days. I was not one of them because of my age and vulnerabilities, but other people who were just as vulnerable had the courage to be out there, and I admire them so much. And I'm very sad that there are few photographs, because the danger of making a photograph was very great during that period.
Yeah, and I hear too that the perhaps the wearing of masks as an accepted part of solidarity and movements is critical to keeping them inclusive and enabling you, for example, to come down and be able to participate and feel comfortable.
Yes.
Comfortable might not be the word when you're facing up tear gas, but, you know, and heavily armed cops and all the rest of it.
To have the courage, yes. And masks do help, but I also know that surveillance methods focusing on the irises of the eye are still being used. And so masks help, and they make us safer, but they do not make us safe. It's not enough to make us safe. We cannot make ourselves entirely safe. And that's what courage is all about. It's about not about being afraid and not minding the fear going forward. I'm thinking of a quote from the T.H. Lawrence movie in which he holds a match and it burns down to his finger. And this young lieutenant says, "How do you do that?" And he said, the trick is not minding that it hurts. And I think that that's what courage is. It's not minding that it hurts. And it's knowing that there is some larger scene, scenario that matters more than my individual hurt.
So thank you so much for speaking with me, Kendall. My guest today has been activist, photographer, writer, poet, actor. Have I missed something? And again, some of Kendall's photographs are on exhibit right now at the Black Gallery, which is run by Don't Shoot Portland, and their website can be found at www.theblackgallerypdx.com. Thank you, Kendall.
Thank you, Desiree.
This has been Desiree Helliger for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
KBOO is people-powered radio. We're on the air not to make a buck, but to make a difference. If that matters to you, then please consider making a donation today to support our fall fund drive. Donate today, and your dollars will be matched dollar for dollar up to $11,000, thanks to generous supporters of KBOO. You can donate by going to kboo.fm/give, by texting KBOO to 44321, or by sending a check to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214.
This is not a war, it is systematic genocide. But wherever they try, Palestine will never die.
Palestine.
They're not prepared to face the pain, so they're scared to say your name.
The word genocide was coined by secular Jew and Polish attorney Raphael Lemkin. To him, the term meant not only physical obliteration of a certain group of people, but their cultural annihilation as well. The legal concept that emerged from the 1948 UN Convention on Genocide, however, was so narrowly defined that it has rarely served as legal redress for the many horrific mass murders since World War II. In a piece titled The Bitter Fight Over the Meaning of Genocide, Linda Kinsler explores the history of the concept and how the horror unfolding in Gaza today is spurring activists to reclaim Lemkin's original and much broader concept. I'm going to read excerpts from the article, which was published in the New York Times on August 20 of this year. Linda Kinsler is a junior fellow at Harvard Society of Fellows and the author of Come to This Court and Cry, How the Holocaust Ends. Here's what Linda Kinsler writes. On February 26, 2007, the International Court of Justice handed down a decision in which they sought to determine whether Serbia had violated the Genocide Convention during the Bosnian War, when Bosnian Serb forces killed an estimated 100,000 civilians. The court declined to classify a vast majority of the Bosnian deaths as genocidal because on only one occasion did the perpetrators explicitly display the specific intent to, quote, destroy in whole or in part the group as such. That specific intent is required for a killing to be considered an instance of genocide. In that ruling, the moral force of the word genocide and the public understanding of the word had become fully detached from its relatively narrow legal meaning. Ever since the Polish lawyer Raphael Lemkin coined the word in 1944, it has been pulled taut between languages, Greek and Latin, legal and moral. In Lemkin's view, genocide encompassed a broad array of crimes committed with the intent to destroy a national, religious, racial, or ethnic group, arguing that genocide included acts not just of physical obliteration, but also of cultural annihilation. For him, it included mass killings as well as the destruction of language, traditions, monuments, artworks, archives, libraries, universities, and places of worship. Lemkin's hope was that coining the word and persuading nations to recognize it as a crime might somehow prevent it from recurring. But by the time the United Nations approved the Genocide Convention on December 9, 1948, which made genocide a crime under international law, only a shadow of Lemkin's original idea survived. After years of contentious deliberation and diplomatic negotiation, the convention limited genocide to five categories of acts: killing members of a group, causing group members serious bodily or mental harm, imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group, forcibly transferring children from one group to another, and, quote, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part, end quote. Each one of those acts could constitute genocide, but only if committed with a specific intent to destroy a protected group. The potential applications of the convention to this day remain undeveloped and untested. For nearly 80 years, the word has been indelibly associated with the Holocaust. To invoke genocide is to immediately conjure up the memory of the destruction of the Jewish people and its associated architecture of murder, concentration camps and deportation trains, ghettos and gas chambers. This relation has at once augmented genocide's moral force and undermined its legal uses. The Holocaust is viewed both as the awful standard against which all modern atrocities must be measured, and as a supposedly unrepeatable catastrophe to which they must never be compared. The Genocide Convention effectively enshrined this paradoxical understanding of the Shoah and established a nearly impossible bar for genocidal intent based on its example. As a result, international courts have rarely recognized more recent mass killings as instances of the crime, and people seeking to have their suffering recognized as such have been bitterly disappointed. At the time of the convention, the Soviets, fearing they could be held accountable for their own domestic mass killings, objected to the protection of political groups under the convention. The Americans, worried about language that could be used to interpret a history of lynching and Jim Crow laws as a form of genocide. Thus, major powers had compromised in favor of a definition that was both narrow and opaque. By codifying genocide this way, the convention paradoxically made it far more difficult to identify and prove, amplifying the concept's rhetorical power while leaving it to the courts to determine how it would be applied. For decades to come, the jurisprudence of genocide remained conspicuously silent, while philosophical and colloquial uses of the word accumulated moral and political force. The strict legal interpretation of genocide has meant that courts might never recognize many of the worst atrocity of the past several decades as genocide. These include the killing of some 300,000 people in the Darfur region of Sudan, the murder of more than a million during the Nigeria-Biafra war, the Iraqi government's mass deportation and killing of an estimated 100,000 Kurds in the late 1980s, the Yazidi massacres by ISIS in 2014, and the Chinese effort to indefinitely detain, re-educate, imprison, and torture Uyghurs. China, like the United States, France, and Russia, refuses to recognize the jurisdiction of the International Court of Justice, shielding themselves from the court's authority. The ongoing debate over whether genocide describes the current Israeli violence in Gaza has become an occasion for politicians, scholars, activists, and lawyers to reappraise the legal architecture and the history that we have all inherited, and to begin to rethink how moral responsibility for the worst categories of crimes ought to be assigned. Over the past several months, as the ICJ has begun to weigh two cases pertaining to Israel and Gaza, protesters around the world have offered their own judgments in advance. "Stop the genocide," their posters have proclaimed. Their signs and demands have sought to mobilize the rhetorical force that genocide has accrued. But if the strict interpretation of the Genocide Convention prevails at the ICJ, it is possible that none of Israel's actions in Gaza will meet the legal definition of the crime. The Genocide Convention emerged as an immediate response to World War II. Today, its terms are being renegotiated in real time as part of an effort to bring them up to date with the last 80 years of war. One likely effect of all this activity is that the court will relax its evidentiary requirements for proving genocidal intent. Loosening the legal interpretation of the special intent requirement, legal scholar William Shabbas argues, would thereby make the convention a living instrument that can be applied. There is also momentum building behind a new convention that would patch the loophole that the Genocide Convention exposed. The new convention aims to carry forward the legacy of the Polish attorney Lemkin and provide a sorely needed mechanism for innocent people to be protected from slaughter, or at the very least to seek legal recourse for their suffering. Lemkin created an important pathway for accountability, but in restricting his pursuit of justice to the courts, he largely avoided questions about how political power can hinder just outcomes. Today, we have another chance to grapple with that problem. Out of the debate over what genocide means in the courts and in the streets, a renewed sense of moral clarity may soon come. I've been reading excerpts from an article titled The Bitter Fight Over the Meaning of Genocide by Linda Kinsler, published in the New York Times on August 20, 2024. A link to the full article is posted on the webpage for this show at kboo.fm.
This is not a war, it is systematic genocide, but whatever they try, Palestine will never die.
Palestine.
They're not prepared to face the pain, so they're scared to say your name.
That's a wrap for our show today. Thanks to Moles, Joe Clement, Desiree Helligers, and Larry Bolden for their contributions, and a special thanks to our guest, Kendall. I also want to give a shout-out to the hardworking staff of your community radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, your host for the Old Mole Variety Hour. KBOO is proud to be one of the longest-lived community radio stations in the country, and it's only through the ongoing support of listeners like you that KBOO continues to thrive. Be part of the community and show your support by going to kboo.fm/give, by texting KBOO to 44321, or by sending a check to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. And in our last week of our fall funding drive, every dollar you donate will be matched dollar for dollar up to $11,000. I'm going to leave you this morning with more of the song we opened with, Palestine Will Never Die by Low Key, and featuring Mai Khalil. Thanks for listening.
This is not a war, it is systematic genocide, but whatever they try, Palestine will never die.
Palestine.
They're not prepared to face the pain, so they're scared to say your name.
Palestine.
They're not prepared to face the pain, so they're scared to say your name.
Palestine.
They're not prepared to face the pain, so they're scared to say your name.
Palestine.